And the only way to overturn a Supreme Court decision is either with another Supreme Court decision or a constitutional amendment. And I don't see two-thirds of either chamber, even with the result of this election, in favor of amending the Constitution to put that in. Well, that, the funny thing is, that's where the trend was going, but this decision stopped the states. Sam is here.
I am here.
Caden is here.
He forced me
over. What?
He forced me over, Steve.
What a bully.
I know. I should kick his ass right now.
You should. Kevin is here, but no Juliana. And Nolan is here. Oh, and Michael is here. And Andrew is here today.
All right, so just a couple of things that I'm going to throw out there. One, obviously, 1 week from today, your papers are due. Papers count as 20% of your grade. And two, as soon as we're done with this stuff, you're going to have your next exam. Will I get through it today? Might. Don't know. We'll see.
So if you've missed any classes, I made sure all the recordings were up to date as of this morning, so go back and listen. Lastly, some of you are going to be impacted when I calculate your final averages based on poor attendance. So if you are over the 6 allowed classes, or you think you are, you have the opportunity to do extra credit to offset the penalties. Because for every absence over 6, it's 3 points that come off. So if you end up with 9 absences, that means 9 points coming off your final average. So you have the ability to do the chapter review questions for the 2 chapters that we covered with this exam that's in the book. And then on the final in Engage, there's something called the Super Mega Extra Credit Packet for the final. Obviously, that's only for the final. You have the ability to do that as well. But if you are one of the 3 or 4 who still has perfect attendance, don't miss any class, because the fact that we're down to so few means their points are going to be so high. And I would love to get down to 1 person, and then I'll give them 10 points.
Let that guy be me.
I thought you were going to have it last semester, but you got called away. No, I excused that. Oh, you had to leave. That's right. You went down to Texas or something like that.
Yeah, that's where you are.
I can't excuse going to a wedding. Guard duty, I can.
It wasn't a wedding. It was a award from my dad that he got at his work.
Oh. Well, water under the bridge. You didn't need the points anyways. Yeah. You're probably not going to need the points this semester either, but we'll see. All right. So, we're dealing with the fact that Japan decided to modernize as a result of the period of time known as the Meiji Restoration, and they did it as a way to keep the barbarians from coming in and doing to Japan what they were doing elsewhere in the world. Japan was the only nation on earth to do it. And they did it successfully by going around the world, observing what they saw, all of the different forms, all of the variations, and then pick what they thought was best, tailor them to Japan's culture and its traditions, and then run with it. But they were limited by the fact that they had residents on an island that you only could use 30% of the actual geography. And Japan was not exactly teeming with the resources necessary for a... Oh, wait, I did this right. To do... There we go. To keep the industrialized process moving. So they saw what the other European nations were doing, and they decided, well, hey, 19th century racism. The best way to prove that you're a superior race is to conquer weaker people. And so they got into the war business. The first war, which they triggered, is known as the First Sino-Japanese War. Because, heck, you want to be able to flex your muscles? Do what everyone else in the world's doing. Kick the living snot out of the Chinese. Now, I don't have time to get into the origins of the war. It's really, really complicated. and it goes back centuries. But to make it simple, for centuries, China believed it was the center of the universe and that all of the countries around it, including Japan, were satellites. Thus, they could wield influence over. But there were some that they viewed as fiefs, territories. And one of them was Korea. Korea had been held in the Chinese sphere for centuries upon centuries. But they had their own monarch. They had their own king. But the king was seen as a, or the king's dome was seen as a tributary state. That its existence was dependent upon China. Well, again, we're keeping long story short. In the 19th century, the same weather that caused chaos in Japan impacted Korea as well. And like Japan, there was instability and there was widespread riots. But the difference wherein Japan, the Tokugawa, was still strong enough to crush the peasant revolts, in Korea they did not have that strength. And China, dealing with the Opium Wars and all the other problems they were dealing with, didn't have the ability to do much. So as a result, China's weakening, Korea's destabilizing, and Japan is getting stronger.
So China just had an ego for centuries and Korea was open.
Korea was always submitted. Fast forward to the 1880s. Japan's going through the Meiji Restoration. China is crumbling. And Korea is still not stable. And here are the Japanese. I wish I had the full island. But they're looking 90 miles across the Sea of Japan. And they see this unstabilized dagger that's pointed at the heart of their empire. They know what the Europeans are doing all up and down the Chinese coast. And the Japanese suddenly became afraid. What happens if the Europeans decide to just pluck Korea out? Korea can't resist and neither can China. So, let's engage in a little preemption. In 1894, Japan contacts the Korean government, who is dealing with this riots, offers them their help in a way that they could not refuse. Soon, Japanese forces are being landed in southern Korea and begin marching north under the guise of helping the Koreans. Their forces maneuver into every province where there is peasant uprising, and they work with the Korean officials and crush the revolts. The problem is, at the same time, Chinese do the same. And the Chinese start marching south and helping wherever they can. And in the end, by spring of 1894, the uprisings had ceased. Well, here is the thing. The Koreans were not pro-Japanese. They were pro-Chinese. But the Japanese contacts the king, King Gojong, and offers the king their perpetual assistance and friendship. Well, the king tries stalling because the king reaches out to China and says, "Hey, Beijing, hey, can you help us?" But we know this is the period when they're trying to engage in some reforms, but you have that palace coup and you have Xerxes, you know, seize power. So they never respond to the Koreans, which angers the Japanese. So the Japanese decide to take it upon themselves. They march into Seoul and they seize the king for his own protection. And under the protection of the Japanese, the king basically begins authorizing his new allies to become more and more aggressive. And at one point, the Japanese military convinces the king, why don't we get rid of the Chinese forces? We'll take it from here. So with the blessing of the King of Korea, the Japanese preemptively strike the Korean, the Chinese forces. And it was quick. It didn't even last 6 months. From Seoul, the Japanese basically marched north and drove the Chinese back in every single direction. Pushed them across the Yalu River and into the Liaotung Peninsula. The Chinese did not stand a chance. Why? Well, look at this Japanese propaganda. The Chinese are still out there with swords and spears. Oh no, Chinamen, oh no. And look at the Japanese, modern uniforms, guns, charging with bayonets. Effectively crushing the little Chinamen. This is my favorite. He's like, oh no. He's like, oh no, Mr. Bill. 35,000 Chinese casualties to 4,000 Japanese. Once peace is restored, Japan makes a pronouncement. By the way, under the rules of effective occupation, you plant the flag, you get a treaty, and you have a right to engage in police work. That's way at the beginning of this unit. What? Bismarck? The Berlin Conference? Japan declares that Korea is a protectorate. Now here's the thing. Because they also kicked the snot out of the Chinese, they want compensation. No. No.
Territory.
They want land. They demand Taiwan, which China gives to them. They also demand the right to claim a sphere of influence over the entire Liaotung Peninsula. Not that they care about the peninsula, but because they want a huge port, one of the largest ports in all of northern China, Port Arthur. But there was a problem, see? And the problem was, is at the same time that the Japanese wanted Port Arthur, guess who also wanted Port Arthur?
The Europeans.
Which one?
I'm going to assume the United States.
No.
The Brits?
No.
Dutch? Germans?
No.
Dutch?
No.
Russians?
The Russians.
I was waiting for that. Oh, yeah, sure thing.
No, that makes sense, because that would be okay.
Last option.
No.
That's because freaking Russia and Japan have gone to war for that territory. That's why.
So the Russians sit back and complain. And who do they complain to? Well, they complain to the French. They complain to the Germans. And they complain to the British. Who then turn around and tell the Japanese, hey, you know something, Japan? You did really good kicking the snot out of the Chinese. You can keep Taiwan. You can keep Korea as a protectorate. But you're not going to get Liaotung. That is going to be considered neutral ground.
Sure.
Well, on one hand,
based under the law rules of 19th century racism. Again, it's not the dumbed down racism that we have today. Remember, there's different views based on all the races.
So amongst the Mongoloids, the Japanese have proved that they are the superior race because they kicked the snot out of the group that thought they were the superior, the Chinese. So once you prove that you are the superior race, what can you do?
Whatever you want.
Why?
Because you're superior.
Because you're superior. And what do all superior races have a right to do under the standards of 19th century racism and social Darwinism? You can conquer. You can take from the weak.
That's a hell of a picture right there.
Which one?
If you go back, those guys getting their heads cut off.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. By the way, these were paintings that were used to describe the details of the battle that every child that went to school in Japan were taught. How do you dispose of your enemies?
Kill them.
Which glorifies the ancient samurai tradition, no?
All right, well, here's the problem. Nowhere else on Earth had any other group of people, any race, any culture, done anything like the Japanese did. They took what the Europeans were doing and made it their own and did it as effective as the Europeans did. This was a game changer because now, previously, the Europeans thought they could do whatever they wanted in the Asian trade network. But now, suddenly, one of those nations are potentially as strong as other European nations. This was huge. They suddenly realized that all of what the Japanese learned made them a first-rate power. And at the same time, China's on the brink of complete collapse. And if China collapses completely, you could suddenly have a situation where not only is Russia and England and Germany jumping in to carve out chunks of China, well, now come the Japanese.
And technically, the Japanese would have kind of home field advantage because they don't have to travel halfway around the world. So, how are we going to prevent the outbreak of war over China? Well, they dealt with Africa. That was the Berlin Conference. But how are they going to deal with the collapse of China?
They're going to have another conference?
Well, they didn't know. So in comes, out of nowhere, America! U.S. Secretary of State for then President William McKinley, John Hay, put forth a memo to all of the great powers that are on the verge of going to war, potentially against one another, over the spoils of China. Now, here's the funny thing. America in the 1890s is not the America that's going to rise after January 20th, 2025. No, no, no. America at this point was not seen as a great power. The United States was deemed to be a regional power.
Because yeah,
isn't we considered power after World War I, right? Right. Right, because what did we have control over? Yeah, we had control of roughly one-third of North America. Actually, it's more than one-third. Maybe not half, but you know, a good chunk of North America we can control. We had control and influence over many of the islands in the Caribbean. After all, we kicked the living snot out of Spain, and we quote-unquote liberated Cuba, but we also took possession of Puerto Rico and the Philippines. We also took Guam as well. We conquered Hawaii, and we took Alaska from Russia.
Didn't we also bitch slap the shit out of Mexico when they were fighting their civil war looking for Pancho Villa?
Yeah, yeah, but I wasn't going to talk about that. But fine, yeah, we kicked the living... Oh, that's... No, 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 no. Pancho Villa invaded an attempt to conquer the Republic of Texas. which made an alliance and thus was brought into the United States. And yes, we did fight a war with Mexico, kicked the living snot out of them, took what we wanted from them, California, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, and then we kind of let them go because we took the lands that was not full of the one thing that we did not want. Mexicans. Mexico was allowed to remain an independent country after us taking all that land because the section that was let go was full of Mexicans. And it had nothing to do with race. I told you guys this, right? Didn't we have this sidebar conversation?
I don't believe we did, no.
The problem with the Mexicans after the Mexican-American War is they were all Catholics. And the United States was anti-Catholic. So had the Mexicans been Protestant, we would have conquered all of Mexico. We would have kept it. But at the time, there was a big movement in the United States that was trying to get out the Irish and the Italian immigrants because they were all papists. In fact, there literally was a political party called the Know Nothing Party whose sole agenda was to be anti-Catholic. So, but for the fact that the Mexicans were Catholic, you know, we would have conquered the whole thing because we did. We invaded, we seized the capital, we completely overthrew the government. We had full control. But President James K. Polk said, too many Catholics. Let them go. But yes. What?
So Catholicism really saved Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. And Catholicism was imposed upon them by the Spanish, which is kind of ironic, right? Now, I don't know how they would have treated them if they were still like pagan. Yeah, if they still did the Aztec human sacrifice and all the rest. Yeah, yeah, they would have probably imposed. You're right, you're right. All right, but that's none. So again, United States. Oh, by the way, America was doing this under the right of the Monroe Doctrine. And ironically, that's what allowed that blanket umbrella is what allowed Latin Central America and South America and the Caribbean to eventually, bit by bit, break away from Spanish rule and become independent countries. Because had it not been from then, when President Monroe basically told the world, the English, the French, and even the Spanish, you don't come in. This is our sphere. You know, world history would have been very, very different. But anyways, so we have control over the Western Hemisphere. We're the regional power. But Hay and McKinley envisioned us as being more global. Not a superpower, but at least a great enough power that when we speak, other nations should listen. So, truth be told, the biggest motivation was is we were trying to shove ourselves to the front of the line. Because even though we were involved in the Opium Wars, we didn't really get much out of it other than money. Yeah, we opened Japan, but look at what the Japanese did. You know, kind of pushed us aside. So we were just trying to nuzzle our way up. And Hay did so in a way that was really, really, truly American. He used the press. And he had a press conference in which there were representatives of all of the world's nations' press present, and he announced that he dispatched notes, which were diplomatic letters, to all of the powers that were carving up China. The British, the Germans, the Russians, the Japanese, the Italians, and the French. And in those notes, he proposed that all of the nations should embrace what he called an open door policy. An open door policy. The open door is based on 3 points. 3 points. Point number one. No nation interferes with others' spheres of influence in China. No nation interferes with the spheres of influence. So, England, for example, had full possession of Hong Kong. So no nation should try to force their way and conquer Hong Kong. Because again, we don't want the European powers fighting one another. But China is on the verge of collapse as a result of losing control of all of the ports, as a result of losing complete control over the Canton system. So, China's right to impose tariffs must be respected. Tariffs, after all, was the primary source of revenue. So if China wants to impose a 10% tariff on any European good coming in, the Europeans should not deny China the right to collect that revenue. Because if China goes bankrupt and completely collapses, China could descend into chaos, and then how can anyone do any business in there?
They love controlling all those people too.
Exactly. Yeah, which at the time it still was the most populated nation on earth. Hundreds of millions of people. They're not all, quite billions.
No, they're all xenophobic too, and they're going to want to kill you.
Oh, absolutely.
The country. They're all going to freaking... Yeah.
100%. If the regime collapses, yes, the Chinese people will unleash hell upon all the round eyes. Now, here's the catch. Here's the catch. You can't interfere with someone else's sphere of influence. You can't interfere with China's right to tariff. But. You can do business in someone else's sphere. So, Hay said, no nation can discriminate against other nationals from utilizing ports or railroad infrastructure to get products out. So, going back to the Hong Kong example, England controls Hong Kong, but if Ford wants to extract iron to make F-150s, and the Ford Motor Company has a contract with some Chinese company, and Hong Kong is the easiest way to get it out, the Brits have to allow the American company to get those minerals out. Can't say no. So you can control it, you can make your regulations, but you can't discriminate against other nations. Because if you start picking and choosing who can do business in your sphere, that could lead to tensions, it could lead to war. And we don't want the great powers fighting over China. Questions?
Is that why China produces shit so cheaply now?
Different reason. That's a story for another day.
Is this later on in history?
Right. So here's the thing. So now, little United States is telling the most powerful empire on earth, England, you gotta do what we want you to. In France, in Germany, in Italy, in Russia, gotta do what we want. Do you think anyone cared?
Nope.
No, not at all. Not a single nation agreed. Not a single nation agreed. Nobody even said, well, let's talk about it. They all laughed. But here's the thing. The one thing that America has that none of the other nations had was we were experiencing a revolution with communication. We had several of the world's leading newspapers in our country. We were also building telegraph lines and wiring services. We had the ability to communicate globally. And so guess what Hay did? He didn't announce that no nation accepted it. No. He announced that everybody's on board. Which I'm sure caused many of the foreign diplomat pools in the other country to sit back and say, wait, who said what? But before they could respond, the Boxer Rebellion erupts. And to Kevin's point, what did the Chinese start doing? They started slaughtering all of the round eyes wherever they found them. Well, when this occurred, all of the Europeans were sitting there wringing their heads together and saying, this could be the justification that we could use to topple the Qing, and we'll just carve up the region. Now, coincidentally, who also joined in? The Japanese. Because you know why? They wanted their taste. But here's the funny thing. The Japanese initially were hesitant because they viewed what the Boxers were doing as a religious movement. It had nothing to do with race in the Japanese eyes, had nothing to do with economics, but it was religion. They viewed the Boxers as a cult. Because what were the Boxers doing? They were attacking the Christians. So many of the Japanese officials were hesitant. And they almost said no until the Boxers began killing the Japanese that were in China as well. And at that point, forget about it. They sent 10,000 soldiers and they went to the nines. But as the counter response to the Boxers was overwhelming, and we talked about that, while that was going on, the United States moved quickly. Why? Well, they wanted to prevent the carving up of China out of the fear of retaliation. So, Hayes begins communicating with the Russians and the Germans and the Italians and the English and the French and even the Japanese. Look, now is not only the time for the open door, but we need to do more. We need to preserve the territorial integrity of China, and we have to preserve the Qing. If we destroy the government, to Kevin's point, chaos will erupt and we'll all get killed. So to this, the Brits and the Germans sat back and said, okay, this is reasonable. And they announced they would sign an agreement to cooperate with one another that would become known as the Yangtze Agreement. Well, this suddenly meant to all of the powers, now you've got three nations that are in alliance. The Americans, the British, and the Germans. You have England that has the largest empire on earth. You have Germany that has the most fierce military fighting force on earth. And then you have the United States, which have resources unfathomable. So the consequences of this was soon Italy and Austria and Russia and everyone else fell in line. That's how we ended up with the Boxer Protocol. If you remember, the Boxer Protocol, no land was taken. No land was taken. All the Qing had to do was get rid of all the pro-Boxer people. And pay money. But instead of taking all of the silver, the terms required a payment scheme. They had 40 years to pay off their obligations. That's America. Well, for playing its role
as a world power
with the Boxer Rebellion, England suddenly recognized the Japanese. And what they did was, again, something that was unprecedented. England kind of did the enemy of my enemy game. They had been dealing with the Russians in modern Iran and in and around the Caucasus. And the Russians are sending this big army, as I told you, 300,000 strong. They invaded Manchuria, and they're beginning to push south. Sorry, Mongolia. And then they're beginning to push into Manchuria. England didn't have an army to send over there to combat the Russians. But they didn't want the Russians to get any stronger. So who has something to lose if the Russians take Manchuria, possibly Korea? Well, the Japanese. So they made an alliance with them. Now, this was largely a defensive treaty. So basically, the terms were straightforward. If Russia attacks Japan, then England would assist. Or if Russia attacks England, Japan would assist. But the problem was, and England would recognize it, Russia had an ally by this time, France. So if Russia attacks Japan and England attacks Russia, then France is going to attack England. Or vice versa. And what made England realize that? After the Boxer Rebellion, Russian forces continued to march south. They were eyeballing not only the Lao Dong Peninsula, but they wanted Port Arthur. And if they're going to take it, they want all of Manchuria as well. Because guess what's up in Manchuria? Coal and iron. In limitless quantities. So what did the Russians want to do? Well, very simple. They wanted to create a sphere over Manchuria. And they precipitated this with seizing the right to build a railroad to their farthest city. Way out here in Vladivostok. Now, if they were to go through Russian lands, it would have to go all through some of the coldest parts of Siberia. But seeing how the Qing were so weak, they received the right to go through Mongolia into China and across Manchuria. Well, if they're allowed to build this railroad, you know what would be even quicker?
They just take it.
If we can just build a railroad down to Port Arthur, instead of shipping tons of coal by land, we can just put it on boats and we can sail it. But who also wants to access those coal reserves?
The Japanese.
And who also wants to be able to utilize one of the biggest ports in all of northern China? Oh. Now, ironically, Japan and Russia tried negotiating. And the Japanese actually acted in good faith. Japan actually suggested, hey, why don't we split the difference? Okay? You know, you recognize our sphere over all of Korea. And then we'll split the Lao Dong Peninsula, and we will grant you perpetual rights to build a railroad right down to Port Arthur. And you can put your ships there, and you can have it duty-free. But the Russians countered. and said, you know, Japanese, little Japanese Asian people, why don't we take all of Lao Tung? And you know something? We don't like the fact that you have a sphere that's getting close to our railroad. So we're going to draw a line halfway through Korea. And you can have the southern peninsula. But we're going to take a sphere over the north. Just to have it like a buffer state.
Well, needless to say, the Japanese sat back and said, wait, under Western standards, we fought a war, we proved our racial superiority by winning the war, and to the victors go the spoils. And now suddenly Russia, who didn't fight any wars, is coming in and trying to take our stuff? Japan wouldn't have anything to do with it. So you know what they did? They launched a preemptive strike against Russia. February 8th, 1904.
Japanese soldiers ripped across the border, went into territory where the Russian forces were, and engaged in conflict. They also deployed their navy and plugged in the Russian ships that were in Port Arthur, which coincidentally happened to be the entire Russian Pacific Fleet. Because Russia moved it from Vladivostok because it's February. And guess what happened to the port of Vladivostok in February?
It froze.
So the Russians were allowed to put their ships in Port Arthur just to kind of sit there for the wintertime. Well, now the Japanese send their ships in. They allow their modern dreadnoughts to raise their guns right at the mouth of the harbor and basically said to the Russians, come on.
In terms of the land battles, Japan won just about every single major battle. Why? Well, very simple. The Tsar didn't receive word that the war erupted for 6 hours. Well, you got to go away the entire Asian landmass to get to St. Petersburg. And then where were all the Russian soldiers? You know, somewhere in Siberia.
Tsar Nicholas also a bit of an idiot?
Well, he also was a racist. Even when he heard what was going on, he just assumed that the Russians could go back and just kind of flick the Japanese away. But we dealt with that in World War I. If you remember, a lot of the Russian generals actually engaged in fist fights with one another because they hated one another. So the Russian generals were fighting each other more than they were trying to fight the Japanese. Which meant there was confusion with the Russian soldiers, and the Japanese had no confusion. They just kicked the living snot out of the Russians.
Wasn't the army fully equipped too?
They were equipped as best as the Russians could equip them, which by Japanese standards was, yeah, pretty poor. Now here's the funny thing.
Very few people take the time to actually research the Russo-Japanese War in detail, but if you actually look at it, what you saw were the way that the modern weapons would impact the battlefield, and as a result, it was actually foreshadowing what would erupt in Western Europe. They would result in trench warfare. Their machine gun nests were lethal, sweeping no man's land, barren. The unleashed, unrestrained bombardment of artillery, pulverizing the enemy lines. And the culmination was the result to fight from defensive positions. You couldn't charge across the battlefield anymore in the face of ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka. The only way to keep your men alive was to dig trenches and keep them down. So if you were going to make a charge, you had to do the woo, blow the whistle over the top charges across no man's land, which resulted in slaughter. On top of that, Russia lost its navy. I already told you what happened to the Pacific Fleet. Well, when the Tsar learned about what happened to the Pacific Fleet, he ordered his Atlantic Fleet to sail all the way around Europe into the Mediterranean through
Thank you. I had a brain fart. I almost said Panama Canal. Suez Canal, all the way through the Indian Ocean, at which point Japan was told by some of their friends, because England controlled the Suez Canal, that the Russians are coming. So they laid in wait. And then in the Tsushima Straits, the Russians are sailing towards Port Arthur, but during the straits, it's constantly foggy. So the Japans had lined up all their gunboats, just basically looking out straight into the straits. And as the Russians went through, they got T-boned with unbelievable artillery bombardments. And the result was Russia lost all 8 of its battleships and 21 smaller support ships.
21.
Japan lost 3 small torpedo boats. Why? What happened? Well, they were driving through the fog. 2 of them crashed into each other and sunk. And then one of them was actually got hit by a shell from one of the Japanese ships that wasn't properly aimed.
Wow.
Yeah, Russia isn't known for being good at war, evidently.
But in the end of the day, it was completely one-sided. Completely one-sided. While it was costly for both, Russia got the brunt of it. 52,000 killed in action. 15,000 died of disease. Plus another 147,000 men were wounded. Not to mention the fact that 80,000 Russians just surrendered to the Japanese. The Japanese, on the other hand, 47,000 killed in action, 27,000 dead by disease, and they didn't keep records of wounded in action.
So how many Russians were
52,000 KIAs, another 15,000 dead by disease.
Oh, good God.
So not only did the Japanese kick the living snot out of the Chinese, now they did something that had never occurred ever. A non-European power kicked the living snot out of the Europeans. So, what do you do? Well, in comes America again. Teddy Roosevelt decided the best way to settle this dispute to prevent future wars was to stand as a mediator. He invited Japanese representatives up to Portsmouth Naval Shipyard up on Seavey Islands near Kittery, Maine. And there in one of the warehouses, they sat down for several weeks and they hammered out what became known as the Treaty of Portsmouth. Now here's the catch. Russia agreed to allow Japan to have full control over Korea. Russia also agreed that Japan has a right to access Chinese ports. But you know what Russia didn't agree to? Pay an indemnity. Every nation up to this point that lost a war always had to pay for it. But Russia didn't pay. Why? That's what Teddy Roosevelt told the Japanese. Look, they're broke. They cannot pay you. But you want to know something funny? The Japanese remembered this insult. And if you look at the admirals that planned Pearl Harbor, they reference the Portsmouth Treaty as one of the reasons why we had to show the Americans our strength, revenge for the dishonor that their Gaijin president showed to the Japanese people. But this is the last click. And thus, we can have our exam over the weekend. I'm so excited. The Japanese did something that no one else had ever done before. Really, I mean, you can't even include the victories that the Turks had over the Balkans. Maybe going back to the Crusades. You know, it was the first time a non-European beat a European power in war. And so what did that mean? Well, now we have another great power on the world stage. And guess what they're going to want?
Everything.
Everything that they can get. And they've proved that they can get it. All right, well, I'm going to be fair to those of you who are here, and I don't really care about the people who are not. We're going to have it on Saturday or we're going to have it on Sunday?
Sunday.
How many people want Saturday?
UFC Saturday.
How many people want Sunday?
Sunday.
All right, I'll send a reminder. Don't forget, Sunday. 8 a.m. till 11:59 p.m. on Sunday. Exam number 3. You guys?
Yeah, football.
We really?
Yeah, on Saturday, home game against Alfred State for the UCFC
championship. No, I'm not being sarcastic because I know in years past there's been good teams, but I haven't heard anything about it.
No, yeah, it's a Saturday at 12.
You know, I'd love to, but I got American Legion business that I need to attend to. Yeah, yeah. But if I didn't, I would.